Good afternoon, everyone, or good evening if you happen to be watching this in the UK, where Natasha Pulley, our author, happens to live. And we are going to be talking, about the Mars House, her amazing new novel. Actually, every one of her novels is amazing, but this one is especially so. And I would like to say that while this is the US cover and it's nice, I think the UK cover, which I hope she will show you, wow, it is really a knockout. And we have imported, or they're coming anyway, UK copies from London. So if you prefer the London cover art and Natasha's signature, you can order one from the Poison Pen. There's somewhat of a price difference, but it's not ridiculous. So that's what I would do. Anyway, this is so much fun, Natasha. And this time I didn't have to practice Russian in order to talk to you. So I'm really excited.
Amazing. It's much nicer when we don't have to speak Russian, isn't it?
It really is. Although, you know, there probably ought to be Mars speak. And Mars speak in this book, well, you tell us about it. It's an interesting blend of language.
It is. So Mars speak in this book is, depending on the situation you're in, it's a kind of modified Mandarin. If you're very upper class, if you're kind of middle class and in a white collar job, you're probably going to be speaking Russian. And if you're working class and doing a drug deal behind the back of a McDonald's, you're probably speaking English. And the idea is that these things are kind of slowly blending together into this thing that they're calling Tharsis after the city, which is called Tharsis. So yeah, language is a big thing in this book.
I love it. You know, the British, different languages, different class levels. I mean, one of the things I really love about this book is in its own way, it's satirical about Britain and British mores and Britain kind of lifestyle, even though we're on Mars and it's primarily a Chinese funded and organized headquarters in Beijing, lots of Americans, whatever. Basically, this is a really fun riff on the British, on Britain. So did you have fun with that?
Yeah, I absolutely did. And it is very much about class. But I would suggest that America has class as well. You just talk about it less. But I think it is as codified into American culture as it is in British culture, to the point that, you know, if you're in Detroit and you're speaking Black English, you're speaking a very, very different kind of English to someone who's, you know, in a beautiful townhouse in the lovely part of New York. You are going to be using very different grammar. It's a dialectical difference in the same way that we have dialectical differences in the UK.
I don't disagree with that, but ours tends to be fall out over race, whereas yours tends to fall out in a different way. So many times.
Absolutely. I mean, I think class can very quickly solidify into a caste system.
Yes.
We
do know.
And
we'll be talking about the Earth Strong and the Transitioned, which are the two major classes. But I'm going to read you my rave review of this book, and then we'll plunge in. I'm not sure Natasha has seen it, so we're going to go for that. And I started out by saying that I had been watching on St. Patrick's Day Sunday several little boats going up and down the Chicago River, turning it green. And it made me realize that we are celebrating the Irish on St. Patrick's Day, where they were reviled in Britain and certainly were not welcomed, particularly when they first came to the U.S. So one of my observations is that we moved from rejection to celebration, or at least acceptance, as each new wave of newcomers becomes more familiar, more visible, and more blended into communities, and really, I should have added, and more dependent upon each other. So what I said about the book is, one of the most brilliant books I've read, I thought you'd like that, Natasha.
I do like that a lot.
That illuminates immigration from within, the arrival of new refugees from a dying Earth to its established colony on Mars, not a science fiction thriller, but a thriller with a thoughtful and amazingly imagined way of life, given the conditions, parentheses, lack of water, lack of oxygen, low gravity with biological repercussions on the Mars colony where the transition dominate the Earth Strong newcomers. It's a political drama. It's a kind of Michael Crichton world-building triumph. It's a delightful riff on being British and British lifestyle. And above all, it's an unlikely love story. Our hero is a former Royal Ballet dancer, once the Swan King, facing penury in prison as an Earthstrong, unless... dot, dot, dot. What do you think? Was that good?
That was ace. I loved it.
I thought you would. And I really loved your book. And, you know, it's so hard when you read just a little publisher blurb and all to know whether you're going to really like a book or not, or what the book is really about. There aren't enough words, you know, and the marketing people do all that often in advance of actually having the book. So, you know, they may not have fully read it or know what's going on. So I think this is a book that you really have to explain to people rather than just leaving them to say, oh, look, it's another science fiction thriller.
Yeah, definitely. And I think I definitely felt that when I was going through the publishing process. And, you know, whenever they would trot me out in front of a new person, a marketer or a publicist or an editor, and they would say, Natasha, talk about what the book's about. And I would go, okay, it's a bit complicated, but...
Well, I'm going to email you my description and you feel free to just read it.
I will forward it to them. Thank you.
You do that. Absolutely true. Well, anyway, and in fact, I'm going to be visiting your publisher and your publisher's office when I come to Capital Crimes at the end of May. I've already spoken to one of them. And excellent. I'm looking forward to that because I haven't been to Bloomsbury for years.
In the UK, I'm no longer published by Bloomsbury. I'm published by Gallansk, which is an arm of Orion.
It is around Orion. You're absolutely right. It's been their science. Actually, hilariously, it was their science fiction. And for a while, Gallansk was their Yellow Jacket crime line. Do you remember that? You're probably not old enough.
They're now, like, this will really upset you, but they're now releasing vintage Yellow Jacket editions.
No, I think, you know, I think actually Penguin had it right, that was a terrific, the little green penguin cover with the little penguin was an ideal branding thing when they started that paperback line. And I thought the Gallants, you know, I started the bookstore in 1989, so all that was still going on. And I used to come over, I belonged to the Crime Writers Association since then. And you could always tell when you saw those sort of violently yellow jackets that you were looking at some very high quality crime.
Yeah, definitely. And they do it. They do it for sci-fi classics as well. The yellow jacket.
I believe it. Well, thank you for updating me. I'm only looking at your US edition, which is still.
Oh, that's all right. No. It's absolutely fine. But no, of course, I am still with Bloomsbury in the US.
Anyway. So I love the fact that every book for you is a whole different experience, but I also like there are some Easter eggs in here from Natasha's earlier books, and I marked one, which comes up quite early in the book on page 14, when in regard to something or other, the footnote is Maury and daughter on Filigree Street had been a watchmaking shop since the 1880s. And then we go on from there. I love the way you brought the watchmaker of Filigree Street into this, you know, into this book.
I just thought there was no reason why not. It can be a continuation of the same world just a couple of hundred years later. I think that's fine. Yeah, no. So it's definitely its own new thing. And I think one of the things that I swore to myself when I was first published was that I was not going to just write the same book again and again and again. And I think to some extent that can sabotage your career if you completely reinvent yourself with every new book. It's often not a very smart thing to do. But I do think that you should be able to move between genres. And I think that if you always sound like you, then hopefully people will follow you over that jump, even if it is a little bit far.
Well, it's more difficult because without a specific branding, people have to work harder. You know, to find it. I mean, you know, there's so many pros and cons to writing series. You know, series authors often feel imprisoned and non-series authors often wish they had that kind of branding. So there's no right answer. You just have to do what you want to do. I haven't mentioned that Natasha has only once actually been to see us. And if I remember right, was it the Lost Future or was it the Bedlam Stacks, the Peruvian book?
The Bedlam Stacks, and we talked about Peru.
That's right. And fortunately, I'd been to Peru, not too far behind when Natasha came to see us. So I really loved all the Peruvian parts. And I especially liked that wonderfully British 19th century thing where they went and did botanical raids for rubber cream pots.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was just outright piracy, you know.
I know. I mean, like, the British Empire was just a giant drug cartel at that point. So,
you know, everybody forgets that it really wasn't, it was never as political an empire as it was a commercial one. You know, the British East India Company was like one of the world, along with the Dutch, one of the world's first shareholder companies. Insurance developed out of it, Lloyd's of London, because, you know, somebody had to insure. Yeah.
Well, I mean, one of the reasons the East India Company was nationalized was that it had the power and money of it, of a nation state. Mm-hmm. And kind of almost unanimously, the British Parliament went, absolutely not. And they nationalized it overnight. It was the most incredible moment of daylight robbery from a national company. I mean, like, can you imagine if the US nationalized Amazon now? That's what it was.
Well, that's very true. Although you have to admit that the Sepoy Rebellion, the fact there was an actual war and the East India Company was fighting it, made it a little more
it made it a little, yeah, more palatable for the general public, I think. But I'm sure it's not the last mega company we'll see nationalized in the next 100 years.
You know, you did some nationalizing after World War II, if I remember right. The railroads, the National Health Service, all like that. Who knows? We appear to be rocketing towards fascism in this country. So, you know, who knows what might happen to us in the event that it does. Rob, my husband and I are moving to New Zealand. So we have that.
Enjoy, yeah, absolutely. Move to New Zealand.
I'm not going to spend my senior years in that version of America, so we'll carry on. But anyway, talk to me about why it is that you were moved to write this. Is it because, in part, immigration is such a global and divisive process going on?
So I think there are lots of reasons why I ended up writing this, and that is absolutely one of them. I got very tired by the divisive nature of a lot of the debate around immigration, like this idea, like, oh, is it good or is it bad? You're just like, it doesn't matter, it's happening. Deal with it. Find a graceful and chivalrous way to deal with it on both sides. So I got very angry about that. And this is very much a book that was written just after the UK's Brexit referendum. So I'd been writing it for after 2016. And it's just, Brexit has been terrible for this country, really. We've become more isolated. We've become culturally much more aggressive and rather nasty. And I think Americans know what I mean when I say how upsetting that is. So immigration is certainly one of the things behind this book. But there are other more joyful things behind it as well, such as when I was a kid, I did exams in astronomy. I got to go out with telescopes and go and look at the moons of Jupiter through an amazing telescope guided by a Cambridge professor when I was 14. It was amazing. And that stuck with me. And I wanted to write about Mars and I wanted to write about gravity for a long time. But I realized very quickly that the kind of story that I wanted to write was going to be technically very tricky and that I wasn't a good enough writer to do it yet. So it went on the back burner for a long time. But the idea has been kicking around for about 10 years.
Well, it's certainly true that the world building that you do in this requires a lot of biological and other considerations. I thought, you know, one of the things that I thought was so impressive was the effect of gravity on, you know, people from Earth landing on Mars and how that would work, you know. And so one of the problems in this book is that they transitioned. People have been there for a while, and the newcomers, called the Earth Strong, is the Earth Strong people. Are denser, heavier, whatever, and can actually seriously injure a transition person just like brushing up against them. So they wear these metal exoskeletons designed to protect, sort of like wrapping yourself in your car or something, you know, designed to protect the transition. But the problem with transitioning is that there are very serious health consequences, life shortening, probably easily mental health problems, depression can develop in the whole bit. So the newcomer is facing a terrible choice of either living in an exoskeleton, except when they're among the other Earth Strong in some kind of ghetto, or going through a transition, in which case they get to have all the perks of being a citizen, but you know, with serious.
But you might lose the use of your spine in the process. Yeah.
Wow, yeah. Or you know, shorten your life or all the other things. So it's a pretty stark choice. For an Earth Strong person. And that's what you give our guide, the Swan King, who is Earth Strong. Catastrophe and has to make a choice.
Yeah, he does. And it's a pretty brutal choice. And some of the science I've made up because it doesn't exist yet, but that central focus on gravity is definitely very much founded in reality. So the gravity of Mars is 1/3 of what it is on Earth. And the unfortunate fact for anyone in the real world who is going to end up on those soon to come Mars missions, which I'm sure we will see develop in the next 5 or 10 years, once you've been there for a certain amount of time, there will be no coming back because your heart muscle will weaken to the point that it can't push against the weight of your body if you were to go back into Earth's atmosphere. So this would be, it's a one-way ticket. And it's really, really tricky. So even if you survive the journey there, which can be very long, even if you survive the radiation and the atmosphere and all the rest of it, you will be seriously physically weakened. And that will be the case for several generations down the line.
Right, until your biology adapts. But, you know, there are actually serious scientific studies and discussions about founding a colony on the moon, founding a colony on Mars, looking for, there's apparently a particularly attractive moon on Jupiter that may have water and whatever it is. But, you know, as the Earth is heating up and other things are going on, or just sheer overpopulation, it's not unreasonable to think back to sort of, you know, what if you were in Europe in the 15th or 16th century and you, well, what if you were Columbus, you know, and you were looking to discover a new world? People have always been willing to travel and take extraordinary risks in order to do something different. So I don't think that settling on Mars or settling on whatever moon it is on Jupiter and all is at all unlikely.
Oh, no, I think it's definitely going to happen. And I think when it does, the consequences on the human body are going to be both fascinating and catastrophic. And that was partly what I was interested in writing about.
Sure. But that was true here when people, you know, when things crawled out of the sea and had to adapt. Evolution's an ongoing process. And, if enough people go there and if they are able to survive, then, you know, evolution will take charge and eventually, you know, it will adapt. You're right. It's the newcomers, the first generation or two, that will take the real pasting.
Yeah. Definitely. And so the book is set about 7 generations down the line, kind of just while evolution is still getting its boots on. So if you're 7th generation, then you're kind of much more okay than you would be if you were 1st generation, but nonetheless, very, very vulnerable. And it is a 7th generation person who the ballet dancer ends up really kind of going to war with a lot of the time.
Indeed. In its own way, isn't it?
Sorry, I didn't catch that last part. I think everything froze.
Sorry, I know it. We're having the internet slightly unstable. I said that in a way, this is one of those enemies to friends rom-com kind of designs.
Absolutely. And it was that was a choice that I made very early on. And I think sometimes if you set it in an unusual place with quite complicated stuff going on, it can be very useful to use a very, very recognizable trope because it grounds things a little bit. And it feels in one way, that it's a huge cliche. And in another way, it's a way to make the story feel familiar, even if there are other elements of it that feel very unfamiliar.
Well, I thought it was very successful. One of the reasons I read it was to see, do you remember Mary Stuart when she wrote her wonderful books? I don't know if you read them, or Victoria Hold, and there were always, it's always a woman and two guys. And you tick-tock back and forth throughout the book about which guy was going to turn out to be the hero and which guy was going to turn out to be, you know, the devil. And would the woman make the right choice?
Yeah.
And you know, it always came out okay, because that was sort of the point of the book. But I felt in a way that that's kind of what was going on here, and except translated to three men. And I thought, it helped pull me through the whole story to figure out how that was going to come out along with everything else.
Yeah. Oh, I'm really glad that it worked. Thanks.
Well, it worked for me. I don't know if it'll work for everybody, but we're only
We'll
talking
see.
about
I'm
me. So.
sure people will get in touch with me on social media and complain about it, but that's
Right.
great.
You know, that's the thing. Everybody reads a book differently. Every single book has its own, every reader has its own version of the book. That's why book clubs flourish and so forth. And so, you know, when we do these conversations, of which I have done, you know, thousands by now, it's always really my reaction to the book and your reaction to my reaction. And that's all we can do.
Absolutely, absolutely. But no, I really like those romance tropes, and I find that I always come back to them. And when I first started writing this, in my mind, it was very much Jane Eyre on Mars.
I can certainly see that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's so the set the kind of the central mystery is so January, who is the ballet dancer, ends up in an arranged marriage with a very, very right-wing Martian politician who may or may not have murdered their last partner. And one of the things that January tries to work out through the book is, you know, did they or not? And then I wrote a very, very balmy couple of chapters toward the end, which I'm very pleased with. And I'm hoping that other people will be pleased with them too.
Well, think back into history. What if you were actually Elizabeth of York and you were compelled to marry Henry VII, never knowing for sure whether he murdered your two brothers,
Oh yeah.
which may be a Shakespearean construct, but or may not. You know, I mean, there are many theories about what happened to the princes in the towers, but nonetheless, it would be pretty unsettling, to have a marriage and have children with somebody that might in fact have killed, certainly killed your uncle, and would very well have killed your younger brothers. So that was people in power were always looking at those kinds of situations, where.
And those weird relationships have always been really intriguing for me. And that's one of the reasons that I included a huge political important arranged marriage, because I think the idea within a novel of one character being shackled to somebody who they really shouldn't be is just a really great recipe for interesting plot, if not open tragedy. There's the whole Greek idea that everything works better if you keep it inside a family. And I think that's really true. Like, tragedy works if it's, you know, mothers and sons and fathers and daughters and husbands and wives. And this was very much that.
Oh, absolutely. I was thinking about Peter O'Toole and his role of, Henry II in, I'm trying to remember, wasn't The Lion in Winter, was whatever the play was, where, he's on stage with Eleanor of Aquitaine and their children are all, plotting to kill him and all the rest of it. And there's this wonderful moment when Peter O'Toole strolls to the front of the stage and he looks out at the audience and he says, "I don't know what historians will write about my life. But I'll say this, it's going to read much better than it's lived." It's an immortal
It's so
line.
much more interesting to read about than it is to live it, I
Well,
imagine.
I've applied that because I find that if you think about that, it can get you, for example, I travel a lot, and anybody who travels a lot has to face unexpected complications that can be really annoying and occasionally dangerous or whatever. And I always say that to myself, that when I get home, that's always my theory. When I get home, it's going to be the stories will be great, and they
Oh
will
my
tell
God.
much better than they lived.
Yes, tell me about it. So I was in Shanghai over the summer, which is the single most stressful trip I've ever done.
Really?
Like,
Why that?
honestly, travel to China by yourself, it's
Oh,
terrible.
yeah.
Like, getting to China now is really, really difficult. You know, most countries, like, so the last time I did a big trip, it was to Peru. If you want a visa to Peru, they go, come on. Have a pisco sour. This is great. You're very welcome. China, they go, bring us the tears of a virgin. And you might be able to have a visa in a couple of months. So that it was very stressful getting there. You have to document absolutely everything about where you're going to be staying, what you're going to be doing. And then when you get there, and I was going to a language school for 6 weeks, the teachers sit you down and say, right, while you're here, Hong Kong and Taiwan are part of China. Repeat after me, Hong Kong and Taiwan are part of China. And you go, okay. And they say things like, be very, very careful about what you post on social media and all the rest of it. And then while I was there though, and while I was learning all this and kind of drowning in it, I did sit back and do exactly what you do, which is I just went, it's going to make a great story later.
Yeah, no, absolutely true. My only trip to China was back in right the year of the Hong Kong handover. And we went to the university. There are several U.S. universities, probably many more than I know, that organize, and partly as a fundraiser thing for the university, organize travel for their alumnus. So we went to China with Northwestern University. I could have gone with Stanford. And so we didn't have to deal with any of it. But also that was 1997. And
The first time I went to China when I was like 21, there were very few restrictions. Like I got a visa and I don't remember it being a problem. This time it was like 3 hours in a visa center in London. And then it was kind of uncertain on the day, would I be able to get in? It's now much stricter, I think. And you're very, very closely monitored while you're there as well.
I'm sure you are. You know, I mean, I've been to Russia several times. And the first time I remember, if you wanted to leave your escorted group, because the first time we went, we were on a cruise, you had to fill out like an 8-page form, went all the way back to grade school about, you know, I mean, serious, you know, every place you'd ever lived and every, you know, whatever. And fortunately, they kept it. So the next time that we went as guests of the Hermitage for a week that was wonderful in St. Petersburg, they had it. So we didn't have
to. In one way, that's great. And in another way, that's terrifying.
Yes.
That they still had the paperwork.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like in China, the bureaucracy is so creaking and inefficient that they probably wouldn't. And I found that very reassuring.
No, I agree with you. It's probably better if you get to start from scratch, even though it takes a lot of time. But, you know, it's all cyclical. We took a lovely cruise around the Black Sea in 2011 and actually got into a little wooden tour boat with Russians and toured the Russian Navy. And I took photographs. And, you know, that was only 13 years ago. And now it's impossible to even imagine that you would do that. So
I don't know about you, but the more I travel and the more people I meet, the more certain I am that people are different from their governments. And you could still probably have a lovely time with a group of Russian tourists on the Black Sea, and you would make friends with Russian sailors and it would be fine. I really felt like that about China as well. The one thing that made me kind of nervous was outside the apartment block where I was staying, there was a huge Communist Party sign, and there was a massive like person high hammer and sickle, and it gave me this kind of like of anxiety. But everyone was fantastic. Like everyone was incredibly kind.
No, I think you're right that people are not their governments, at least. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem to be true here in the U.S. at the moment, but we'll see. So why were you in Shanghai? Did you need to learn Chinese in order to write this book, or are you working on a different book?
Well, so it had two purposes. One was to sufficiently learn Mandarin to the point that I could more or less get to where January is in the book with language, so I could gauge what he would and wouldn't know. I wanted that to be realistic because there's nothing drives me up the wall more than a character in a book who says they kind of speak a language and then has a conversation about rocket science. I'm just like, no. So it was partly that. And in the footnotes, if people read the footnotes, there's lots of like little anecdotes about Mandarin. All of those are true. My favorite thing that I ever came across with Mandarin is really, really simple, and it's childish humor. But the word for toilet is horse bucket. That's how it's written, horse and bucket. And then when you go out to the sink, it's a hand washing pond. So flush the horse bucket and then use the hand washing pond. That was the sign in the school loos. And every day I cracked up because I was just like, this is a wonderful language. I love this. I would live here if circumstances were different. So just little joyful things like that went into the book. The other purpose was that it had been a long time since I had been actually living in a country that was a long way from mine. And I wanted to remember what it was like to be a foreigner, and to not just be a foreigner, but to be an obvious foreigner. So I would get the metro to school every day. I would be the only white person on the train. I wanted to remember what that was like.
I'm sure that both of those informed your novel in a way that without that experience, because the book feels so real. I mean, it really does. It doesn't feel, I'm sorry about my voice. I keep losing it. It doesn't feel like fantasy or romantasy, you know, these two big things. I mean, it actually is a thriller. It's not a romance. I mean, there's romance in it, but that's not the purpose of the book. But it feels as though it could really be happening. And I think that, you know, your care to do those two things, among other things, is responsible for that.
Oh, thanks very much. I think they definitely, being in Shanghai did definitely change the book. And I wrote part of it while I was there. I was doing the kind of final edits and the final drafting while I was sitting in, I had a favorite cafe. This also makes me happy. So I went to Starbucks a lot, but you can't say Starbucks in China because nobody understands what you mean. So they actually translate it, Shinbaku. And that literally means star bucks, which I think is really, really sweet.
Very sweet. Oh, I really like that. Right.
Yeah.
Yep. It's amazing the penetration that Starbucks as a company has had globally. When we went to the Sharjah Book Festival, they didn't serve, I'm trying to remember, whatever breakfast was, it was more dinner stuff than breakfast stuff. And I thought, I just can't eat any more hummus. And in the hotel that we were staying in. And so amazingly, there really was a Starbucks up the road. And even though it was different, the pastries were Arabic, you know, I mean, it was a different Starbucks. That was fine. But it was actually more like what I think of as breakfast, i.e. coffee and, you know, something pastry rather than vegetables and hummus. It's just not my jam at breakfast. So we went to Starbucks, and I thought it was a fascinating experience to see how it had adapted to the Sharjah, you know, Arab culture as a business model for where it was.
Yeah, absolutely. And you see it in China as well. Like it was near the Mid-Autumn Festival when I was there, and they were selling mooncakes, like very beautiful Starbucks branded mooncakes, which was really, really
That's
sweet.
Very nice. I'm trying to remember, I think the only country I can remember traveling in that makes an actual production out of not having Starbucks is Sweden.
Oh, interesting.
An absolute, I mean, that's a point of pride with them. Now it may change because I haven't been there for a little while, but not Starbucks was kind of a, you know, advertising thing. So we'll see.
Yeah.
Anyway, why did you make January a ballet dancer, and particularly the Swan King? Was it because he would have been in sort of peak physical condition?
Exactly. So the big difficulty on Mars is that people who are from Earth are far too strong. And that's even ordinary people who are not athletes. But what I wanted to do was have a character who was an athlete and whose whole identity rested on having that physical strength. So he's in a difficult position because at the start of the book, he's 30, and that means that he's right at the end of his dancing career, and he knows he is. So he's trying to get used to the idea that he will not be able to do this for very much longer. Ballet is punishing and damaging on joints. So he's preparing for it, but it happens very, very suddenly. And when he ends up on Mars being asked, you know, are you going to naturalize? Are you going to let all this muscle mass go? Are you going to become 2/3 weaker than you started out with? He just kind of locks up about it, and he can't even think about it because so much of his sense of who he is in his physicality and in his strength. So, and I, but I also wanted it to be something entirely benign. So he could have been an Olympic boxer or a sprinter or a soldier, but those things can be quite aggressive. And I wanted something that required strength, but was obviously harmless as well. Mm. And this is one of the things, this is one of the arguments that he makes through the book. Like, you know, you have to be strong to murder someone, but you have to be really strong to dance as well.
Absolutely true. He also, as any performer, is addicted to applause. And so that's the other thing he's facing, is not just, you know, the end of dancing, but the end. I mean, the Swan King is a big role. You know, he's not like, you know, he's a principal dancer. He's not, you know, off there in the male chorus. And
He wasn't cast as the corpse. He's the king.
He's, you know, he's facing, and I think that's true of anyone who is used to the spotlight, unless of course they open a bookstore and then they can create their own, but that's all a different question. It's very hard to, you know, to contemplate life without that mirror of an audience and applause always looking back at you. You know, how do you get around that?
Yeah, and just the kind of the rush and the joy of performance as well. And so this again is one of the reasons that he ends up in this very spotlit political marriage. So on his wedding day, you know, billions of people watch. It's I based it on the British royal weddings that seem to be everywhere all the time. So there's this kind of mania for the glamour of the great political houses on Mars, and he becomes part of it. And one of the reasons he says yes to this is that that kind of performance is what he's trained for. And to some extent, he's very well qualified to step into this new, though peculiar, role, where the alternative would really be, at the point at which he agrees to it, a life of crime or the very worst kind of grungy factory work.
Well, he was actually looking at prison, you know, for a while, which is a game changer. But also, he was also looking at, as I said, penury at, you know, at debt, because if he had no means to support himself, he would almost inevitably end up in prison or dead. So, you know, and those are all things that immigrants face. You know, what happens if you can't penetrate the culture? What happens if you can't make any money? What happens if you, you know, commit a crime and are thrust into the prison system, whatever? I thought, you know, you mirrored the predicaments of immigrants here from one country to another rather well.
Thank you. And I think one of the big concerns that I had was, what does it feel like when the society you live in decides that you are surplus to requirements? This is definitely what happens to January. And it's definitely something that I notice here. We have so many people who have come from a long way, far-flung countries, who are doctors and dentists and nurses, and we don't let them work. Why? It's ludicrous. So January is in very much that situation.
Well, that's a constant problem across the world. And, you know, one of the reasons for it is that in the downfall, I think, of all empires, is that once a country is successful and begins to have enough wealth that people don't have to do the really hard things, they bring in other people to do them. And, you know, I think about the Pakistani population, for example, in the north of England, which was brought in because people didn't want to work in the mills anymore when, you know, there was enough money and so forth that they could stop doing that. But nobody ever seems to think, you know, what will happen, certainly true in America here, you know, with the slave population that was brought in to work those agricultural economies. Nobody stops to think what will happen when that economy changes, or there they are, you know, maybe they begin to outnumber you. Sharjah was an excellent example in point. There was a whole upper class of Sharjah citizens, but all the work was being done by an underclass. I can't remember if they were Tamil. They were, you know, smaller, darker, and brought in from, I can't remember, Africa or India, whatever, but they were, it was just a classic, you know, example of it, where, and the other tendency always seems to be that the lighter skinned people dominate at the top. It's kind of like the cream rising or something, you know.
It's very weird, the whole process. I really agree. It's really, really odd.
True in India. Yeah, you know, in India, the farther south you go, the darker they are. And so you move up, and by the time you get up to the Mughals, whatever. It's just been a a constant, you know, of history, that the cycle goes on. And
it's the same in China as well, actually. The darker you are, the more likely you are to be working class.
Yep. And again, you know, when there's an upper class, I mean, it's obscene the amount of money some people have. And I fully understand the enormous resentment that people with less money who are just desperately trying to get by. There's an article today about, I'm trying to remember, Houston, Texas. Texas is a complicated state. And they had decided to take some surplus money from COVID and award people below a certain income level or however they decided to do it, $500, it's either a month, I think. I don't think it was a week, but anyway, some sort of extra subsistence money because they were barely getting by. And one of the women who was in line to get this said, you know, it was the difference really almost between life and death for her. And some GOP lawmaker has gone, no, we can't do that. You know, that's too close to socialism. And I thought, you fat prick, you know, you have no idea what she's facing, what it's like, and why in the world. You know, you would think that it was, I mean, I understand the intellectual argument, but, you know, when faced with real people really suffering, why would you do that?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I think it takes a very cold person to be entirely clockwork about it and say, well, you know, intellectually, it doesn't add up. You're like, well, but personally, it does. Give the woman $500.
Yeah, but, you know, I think that the divide between wealth and not wealth is increasing dramatically at the moment for a whole lot of reasons. And that's creating more and more tension between it all. And, you know, at some point, something will happen. I mean, right now, I read today that the great COVID era real estate boom, personified in Austin, Texas, but also really hitting Nashville, Tennessee, and Phoenix, has largely burst. And so the overbuilding and the, you know, job receding and the whole bit is suddenly, and, you know, that has been the cycle, certainly here in Phoenix, my entire lifetime has been a boom or bust real estate cycle, you know, and, you know, you build it up and then it sort of falls apart. And then, and that's really, everything is cyclical. History is cyclical. So, you know, it depends on, it's luck to a great degree upon which part of the cycle you're in.
Oh, yeah. And I think the most irritating thing about the cyclical nature is it's not a perfect circle. It's not entirely predictable. It's a kind of spiral. Mm-hmm. So it rhymes. It's never quite the same. It's not quite similar enough to be entirely predictable all the way up. But there it goes nonetheless. And after 70 years, you go, oh, yeah, I see all the bust parts all the way down.
That's very true. That's one reason we should be reading more historical fiction. There are so many lessons to be drawn from that. Also, it's a safer place to be at the moment because we know how it came out. You know, if you had lived through World War II, never knowing how it was going to come out, it would have been a lot more stressful than today reading about it, where you know what happened. And I mean, individual stories are crushing, but overall, you know what the outcome is, regardless of the horrendous price that too many people paid.
Absolutely. And I think there's a bit of a difficulty with historical fiction, particularly in using it to learn lessons, because certainly you can. But I think a problem is that we overlay historical fiction with nostalgia for a time that of course, it wasn't like this at the time, but of certainty and of knowing what was going to happen. And of course, that's only in retrospect that we have certainty of what's going to happen. So there is a coziness to reading about World War II, even the most harrowing story, because you know how it turns out in the end. And that's going to be very different to the life that you're currently living, where you have no idea how it turns out in the end, or if you're going to be hit by a truck tomorrow. So I think there's a kind of, yeah, it's one of the things that I really feel when I write historical fiction, is that there is this pane of glass between you and them. It's protective because you know how it finished.
You only have to read all the Regency romances and so forth and try to remember that was a 20-year war and no one knew how it was going to come out till Waterloo. And yet, you know, if you read about it now, it was like it was a little action over there on the, you know, in the Portuguese Peninsula or something. And, you know, it wasn't like that at all. And the aftermath of it, like the aftermath here after the Vietnam War, was horrendous. You know, you had all kinds of, you know, soldiers who'd fought, who had injuries, who had all kinds of, you know, monetary and supply side issues and all kinds of stuff. But you can read it now and it all sounds like just Jane Austen all the time, you know, and it wasn't.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're quite right.
So tell me about what you're working on next, because the Mars House is published, and knowing Natasha, she's already got another book on the boil. So what will it be?
Oh, well, you know, I need it to pay my mortgage, right?
Well, it's true. If you're a if you're a working author, it's absolutely true that you have to keep publishing, or the money stops.
How I pay the bills. Mars was a huge departure for me. Science fiction, never done that before. What's next is right in the opposite direction. Going back to about 1300 BC to the Trojan War. It's about the after. It's actually exactly about what you were just talking about. So the aftermath of the Trojan War and how catastrophic that was in Thebes, which was a Greek city-state. And it's about Dionysus, the god of madness. I read the Bacchae some time ago and thought, this is fascinating. What drives a whole group of people completely insane overnight? And so what I've tried to do is apply that to a historical setting. It's narrated by a soldier who's just come home from the Trojan War, and who meets this person who seems to be a witch, but of course is a god. So it's entirely different from the Mars House, but I think I still sound like me in it. So again, I'm hoping that people will follow me over that cavernous gap.
I certainly will. Actually, you're kind of in a trend, because there is, as you probably noticed, a huge market at the moment for Tales of the Gods. And I myself, two of my absolute favorite books are Mary Renault, The Bull from the Sea and The King Must Die. And if you read those, you're hooked.
I love Mary Renault. Very.
But those two books, you know, and Dionysus or Bacchae comes into it, you know, when you try to figure out what happens in part. But I do think right at the moment, you're writing on trend, kiddo.
I know. And it's, as if ancient Greece hasn't been done to death in the last 10 years. We don't need another Greek book, but that's what I'm writing anyway. I just got really interested because I love ancient Greek. And so last year I bought myself some textbooks and I learned to read Greek and I read bits of the Iliad and whatnot in Greek and lots of plays and I loved it. But one of the huge questions in my mind was, why is Dionysus not in the Iliad? He was a huge god, even in Mycenaean Greece, more offerings of honey and wine than Zeus. What happened? So I wanted to write about what happened.
Oh, well, now I'm all excited. I can hardly wait. Well, let's call Jacob up and see if anybody else is excited or has questions or whatever. Maybe Jacob even has questions. So we'll see. Are you there, Jake? There you are.
Coffee break.
Hey there. Yeah, we definitely have a few questions. Robin asked, how many languages do you speak, fluently or even not so much?
Oh, God. I feel like what I should say is how many languages have I at some point spoken? So my second language is Japanese, the third is Spanish, the fourth is Russian, the fifth is Mandarin. I now don't function very well in Japanese. I can watch a movie in Latin Spanish and understand about 50% of it, and I'm pretty abysmal in Russian now. Mandarin a bit fresher, but I'm already forgetting how to read. So it's just this process of erosion that is very, very upsetting. I feel like my life has happened to me in languages I no longer speak. So yeah, five.
You have to have constant practice. I mean, yeah, my Russian is really rudimentary at this point. I can say, you know, kakvi pishavetsi, but you know, or dobry день, or you know, whatever. But if you don't use it, you lose it.
Well, I don't know. I think it comes back very, very quickly once you do use it again. But I think your brain prioritizes whatever the language is that you're using now. And so everything else goes into like deep storage at the back. Right. And it is there, but you'd have to really struggle to get it.
I find that you can read it more easily than you can speak it once you are no longer immersed in it. It's hard to summon up the words, but you can recognize them much
yes,
more.
Yes, that's very true. I can read Spanish fine. Right.
Even read German, and I only took a year of German, so there we are. All right. Anyway, carry on, Jay.
Yeah. What kind of research do you do to make your imaginary politics seem novel but also realistic? And how much free rein do you give your imagination in that regard, as opposed to taking cues from history?
Well, so I think there is a lot of history involved. I will definitely. So one of the things that I love doing, because I'm a dork, is on the way to work, I listen to lectures. There's a great lecture series called The Great Courses. And I listen to a lot of lectures about Communist Party politics in Russia and in China, the building of different countries, historical and modern, different mythologies, different all sorts, like across many, many subjects, like from politics to chemistry. I just like someone talking to me about academic stuff for half an hour. So a lot of it comes from that. But I think with regard to political research, really all you need to do is watch the news. And I will say, by the way, that the British news is a lot better than anything that you're going to get in the States. It's they have a certain they have to tell the truth. And if they have said something inaccurate, it is widely reported and everyone gets angry with them. Some people will disagree with me about that, but the BBC is a very, very, very good news service. So I feel like if you watch that, you do get a fairly okay overview of what really is going on. Perhaps that's hopelessly naive of me, but yeah, watch politics, watch the news, and then synthesize. Have you seen this story five times before? If you have, then this might just be a thing that humans do, in which case it goes into the book.
Great. I don't know if this just specifically applies to this novel, but when you're starting a new project, do you usually start with a sociological problem? And then the characters and the setting and the plot comes out of that? Or do you start with characters?
I definitely start with characters. So small things about them, like their profession, will definitely change. But the core of who they are and how they talk and what they're like tends not to. And I think it's partly because whenever I start writing, my first draft always looks like a script. It's just dialogue. So everything else tends to come after that. And often what that becomes is affected by what works in that dialogue. Is there an interesting conflict? What are these people arguing about? And then that becomes the plot of the book. But it does definitely begin with characters. Even Mars began with characters, even though I've then tailored them very carefully to fit their respective sociological issues.
Well, this is your first science fiction novel, is it?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, sci-fi is such a great way to shine light or explore kind of really deep subjects explicitly, not without any nuances, like in a typical, you know, realistic modern day setting. One of the questions that you seem to be asking is what does it mean to be human, right? With all these physiological changes within human beings, but there's no mental change. All of my people are still acting like human beings. And I mean, what do you think? What does it make us, or what are the qualities of being human? And then how do you tackle that in the book?
Yeah. In this book, the overwhelming thing is actually what Barbara and I were just talking about, what she was complaining about, what the GOP senator refused to do, which is exercise basic compassion. I think you can be intellectual and mechanical and cold, but in the end, if you don't have sufficient compassion, you've lost something vital and crucial. So in this, it all boils down to compassion. And in the end, the person who has compassion is the person who wins, because I'm not writing about the real world. I'm writing about a happy imaginary world where things happen because I want them to.
Well, that's it.
Let me say again that I don't really think of this as a science fiction book. I mean, I grant you that the idea of a colony on Mars and so forth sort of, you know, tags it that way. But I don't know that it's certainly, it isn't like reading Dune or something. I mean, it's very, very different reading experience. And I want science fiction fans to read it, but I don't want to put off people who aren't necessarily fans of sci-fi thrillers. Or, you know, this is not an apocalypse book. It's not, you know, that kind of a thing. I think it's just a wonderful combination. It's like a great novel. It's almost like a Bildungsroman. I can't even pronounce that word. What's the word?
Bildungsroman, is it?
Yeah, that one, right. Anyway, yeah. I really loved it. And as you can see, it's a fairly substantial book, and therefore I recommend it for summer reading. I mean, I know it's out now, but this is the sort of book that you really could take with you on a cruise or on, you know, some sort of a trip where you can read it at your leisure and enjoy it. You don't want to be interrupted constantly while you're reading it. So I'm giving it to my husband to take on a cruise that we're going on. And I think he'll really enjoy it. But that's the kind of audience I think that will benefit the most from this book.
That sounds, yeah, I agree. That sounds brilliant. Take it on a cruise. Everybody go on a cruise quickly.
Right. So I hope I might get to see you in London while I'm there at the end of May. So I'll drop you a note about when I'm actually there. Have you enrolled in Capital Crimes at all?
No, I haven't. But I don't live that far from London. So
no, I know you don't. That's why I sort of mentioned it.
Yeah, absolutely. Right.
But
so
I,
you let me know, absolutely.
Yeah, I will. Maybe we can meet up for tea or something along those lines. Anyway, thank you all very much for watching it this afternoon. I repeat that the Mars House is out now and we have copies in the store. And you want to hold up the British edition again because it's so beautiful. There it is. And those are coming in from London. So you still have time to order one of those if you would like. So Natasha, have a wonderful evening. Bye, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.